Welcome to episode 273 of the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. If you want to burn fat, gain energy, and enhance your health by changing when you eat, not what you eat, with no calorie counting, then this show is for you. I'm Melanie Avalon, biohacker and author of What When Wine. Lose weight and feel great with paleo-style meals, intermittent fasting, and wine. And I'm here with my co-host, Cynthia Thurlow, nurse practitioner and author of Intermittent Fasting Transformation, the 45-day program for women to lose stubborn weight, improve hormonal health, and slow aging. For more on us, check out ifpodcast.com, melanieavalon.com, and cynthiathurlow.com. Please remember, the thoughts and opinions on this show do not constitute medical advice or treatment, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. So, pour yourself a mug of black coffee, a cup of tea, or even a glass of wine, if it's that time, and get ready for the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. Hi, friends. I'm about to tell you how to get free grass-fed, grass-finished ground beef for life plus $20 off. Yes, that's free ground beef for life plus $20 off. It can be really hard to find high quality meat and seafood that you can trust. And that's just a start. What about convenient high quality meat and seafood you can trust? This is why I am obsessed with ButcherBox. They provide easy access to 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork that is raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Everything is humanely raised, there are no antibiotics or added hormones, and they make it super convenient and affordable. It's delivered straight to your doorstep with free shipping, and they have curated customized box plans. How do they make this so affordable and so incredible and so easy for you? It's because they directly partner with farmers, so they cut out the middleman of the grocery store. People often talk about how it can be hard to make healthy eating a part of your lifestyle. With ButcherBox, there's literally no excuse. They make it so easy and so affordable. What if you could just always be prepared with delicious, nutritious meat in your freezer without going to the grocery store? And where else can you get free protein for an entire year? Plus, their meat tastes delicious. I feel so spoiled with ButcherBox because their fillets are honestly the most delicious steak fillets I think I've ever had. Whenever I go to restaurants, I typically order steaks, and honestly, it doesn't even barely compare to ButcherBox. Their chicken is also incredible. It's a great source of lean protein. And their fish, as you guys may or may not be aware, did you know there's a lot of fraud when it comes to fish? Studies have found that a large portion of fish in supermarkets and restaurants often isn't the species that it says it is. It is so shocking. ButcherBox solves all of that. And they have so many different types of cuts beyond the fillet that I mentioned. So there really is something for everyone. They even have something I talk about a lot, which is scallops. Today, ButcherBox is giving our listeners free ground beef for the life of your membership, plus an additional $20 off your first order. Just go to butcherbox.com/ifpodcast and use code ifpodcast to get free ground beef for life. That's grass-fed, grass-finished ground beef plus $20 off your first box. That's butcherbox.com/ifpodcast with code ifpodcast. And we'll put all this information in the show notes.
One more thing before we jump in. Did you know that common ingredients found in skincare and makeup products can actually disrupt your endocrine system? These endocrine disruptors are a silent threat that can have significant impact on your health, including something that is very important to me, fertility. Your skin is your body's largest organ, and what you put on it matters. Endocrine disruptors are chemicals that interfere with the natural hormonal communication in the body. It also matters during pregnancy, and that's one of the reasons I pay close attention to what I put on my skin while being pregnant. Studies have shown that exposure to endocrine disruptors can affect both male and female fertility. For women, these disruptors can lead to irregular menstrual cycles, ovulation issues, and even polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS. In men, they can reduce sperm quality and quantity, making it even more challenging to conceive. But it's not just about fertility. When it comes to fat loss, one of the reasons reasons that endocrine disruptors can get in the way of fat loss is because a lot of our toxins are actually stored in our fat. It's a way that our bodies protect us from those toxins. These toxic compounds can even work synergistically, amplifying their harmful effects and making it that much harder to shed unwanted body fat. All of these reasons are why I am obsessed with a company called Beauty Counter. The founder actually started the company when she learned about the potential dangers of toxic chemicals and their link to health issues, specifically miscarriages and infertility. While pregnant, I make sure to only use Beauty Counter products. It's one of the only makeup lines that is officially recommended from the Environmental Working Group. What really sets Beauty Counter apart is their unwavering commitment to protecting us, the consumers, from the hidden dangers that lurk in conventional beauty products. Beauty Counter goes above and beyond, rigorously screening every single ingredient that goes into their products, ensuring that they are safe, clean, and free from harmful toxins. They're not just a beauty brand, they're a movement for change, advocating for stronger regulations in the beauty industry. With Beauty Counter, I know that I can trust that the skincare and makeup that I use are not only effective, but also safe for me and my family. They have skincare lines for every skin type, as well as so many other incredible products. I absolutely love their overnight resurfacing peel. It's my favorite way to get anti-aging benefits in a skincare product. The makeup is absolutely amazing. I have tried alternative beauty products in the past and none of them truly performed. But with Beauty Counter, the foundation is so amazing. It makes me feel like my skin can breathe and it looks so dewy and beautiful. You can shop with me at beautycounter.com/VanessaSpina. New customers can use the code CLEANFORALL20 for 20% off their first order. Beautycounter.com/VanessaSpina. All right, friends, now back to the show.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so excited for you guys for our conversation today because this is a super special episode of the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. We very rarely have guests on this show. So if we have a guest on this show, it's because you know that we really, really love the work and the thoughts and opinions and knowledge and science of the guest that we brought on. So I am so honored to be here today with Rick Johnson. So the backstory on this is I was first exposed to Rick's work a few years ago. I heard him on Peter Attia's podcast, and you guys know that we love Peter Attia. I was fascinated because I personally am very fascinated with the role of fructose in our diets. I mean, I know that's a very granular thing to be obsessed with, but I was so excited that there was somebody else who was really looking at the science of fructose metabolism. And so I got his first book, The Fat Switch. And then fast forward, I really, really wanted to interview him. And then I heard him again, much more recently, again on Peter Attia's podcast, because he has a new book out called Nature Wants Us to Be Fat, The Surprising Science Behind Why We Gain Weight and How We Can Prevent and Reverse It. I was like, I've got to book him for the show, for the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. And then his people actually came to me, his publicist or PR people, asking to come on the show. So I was so, so excited. That episode actually, as of our recording right now, is actually airing today on the Biohacking Podcast. But when this comes out, that will have been a few weeks ago. But I just so enjoyed that conversation. And then since then, Rick and I have been emailing and diving deeper into the science of everything. And I just knew I had to bring him on this show to share all of his incredible work with you guys. So I'm really happy right now. Rick, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's an absolute pleasure. Really.
I was just telling you this offline, but for Cynthia Thurlow's other podcasts for listeners, she also recently aired an episode with Rick and said it was her most downloaded episode of the year. And she interviews a lot of heavy hitters. So that's pretty cool. So this content is definitely resonating with people. But so Rick, for people who are not familiar with you, there might be some people who have listened to your other episodes, but for those who are not, what is your story? So you're currently a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado, but what led you to where you are today with your fascination with fructose and this thing called the survival switch and obesity and just everything?
you know, I went to medical school, trained to be a physician, and did my specialty in kidney diseases as well as internal medicine. But from the very start, you know, I always was very interested in the why, not just how to manage a person, but why were they developing diabetes? Why were they developing kidney disease? And so I began my career quite a few years ago, where I was both a clinician as well as a researcher. Got a lot of funding from the National Institute of Health to help me along the way. And over the last, you know, years, I've been doing research. It started off in kidney disease, and then I became interested in high blood pressure, because high blood pressure is linked with the kidney. From there, I discovered that there was a substance in our blood called uric acid, and that substance was very strongly associated with high blood pressure. And we actually found evidence that it might actually play a role in high blood pressure. Big surprise. And I just kept following my nose along the way to try to figure out what was, you know, this pathway. And then pretty soon I became interested in, well, okay, if uric acid is so important, what's driving the uric acid up in our population? You know, because there's a lot of people with high uric acids. And, you know, the classic teaching was it was from eating purine-rich foods, you know, because high uric acid is associated with a disease called gout. And so it's associated with like drinking beer and eating a lot of meats and stuff. But there's another food that dries up uric acid, and it's sugar. And table sugar or high fructose corn syrup contains fructose. And fructose is a carbohydrate. It's the sugar in fruit. But if you eat it, it will generate uric acid. And particularly if you eat a lot of it, you can really raise the uric acid in your inside your body. And it turns out that that led me to kind of some big discoveries, because the uric acid turned out to have a role in driving obesity and diabetes. And it led me to realize that fructose was really a culprit. And then from there, I started studying fructose, and I found out that it wasn't just the fructose that we eat, but that our bodies can make fructose. And that this kind of opened the door for what might be causing the whole obesity epidemic. So it was a long story. It took me everywhere. So I did studies in hibernating animals, and I did studies in people, and I did studies in genetically modified mice, and I did studies in indigenous tribes living in the jungle. I even did studies where we resurrected extinct genes. So I've been around, and it has been an adventure story, Melanie.
I love it so much. And actually, to that point, your book, one of the things I really love about it is it reads like an adventure story, especially the very beginning where you're talking about, it's like a mystery of, you know, why did we become fat, like as a society? And you talk about really fascinating things that happen in animals. Like, could you tell listeners about the hummingbird, for example?
Yeah. Oh, we think of the hummingbird as this magnificent bird that has the fastest metabolism of perhaps all birds. I mean, I think that it, you know, it flaps its wings like, 250 times a minute. And I mean, it's just, you know, it has an incredible metabolism. And you would think, you know, that bird must be the healthiest bird in the world. But it lives off nectar. And nectar is really sugar water. And that contains a lot of fructose. It contains fructose and glucose. And when that hummingbird drinks this nectar, it's getting a very large amount of sugar. And what happens is during the day, that sugar is so strong that the little bird becomes diabetic. Its blood sugars go up to like 500. And it gets perhaps the fattest liver of any bird. It turns like glistening white. And so by the end of the day, it's fat and diabetic. And then during the night, it will rest, and it will burn off the fat and the glucose. And in the morning, it will be back to its normal state. And so it's like intermittent fasting, because the little bird, he gets really fat, and then he fasts through the night. Interestingly, if they burn off all the fat and the carbs, then he'll kind of go into torpor, which is sort of like a hibernation state. where they drop their metabolism, drop their blood temperature and all that, you know, so their body temperature. So yeah, no, it's a very interesting bird.
With those huge spikes in blood sugar, which that blew my mind when I first read that, is it getting the effects of like glycated hemoglobin? Like, does it have an HbA1c and things like that? Like, how does it long-term, how is it handling those spikes?
Well, one of the interesting things is there's not a lot of studies of hummingbirds long-term, but what has been done suggests that they actually do all right. So that their you know, what happens is that they have such good mitochondria and they have this very good protective system to help protect the mitochondria from getting permanently damaged. They pair to not get diabetic complications. So they've been able to survive diabetes without the complications. And again, you know, we can talk about, you know, what drives diabetic complications and all that kind of thing, but it's really interesting that these guys will raise their blood sugars to over 500. I mean, these are very high blood sugar levels, but they seem to be relatively protected. Although I think more studies, you know, really need to be done, but the initial reports suggest that they're pretty protected, even though they're very diabetic.
Does that insinuate, and this is completely theoretical and not real life at all, but if we could have a metabolism fast enough to burn off everything that we are eating, or if we could literally exercise until we exercised off all of our excess calories, that we could mitigate damage ourselves?
I think that's true. So there are people who have super mitochondria. There really are. There are people running around. There tend to be the super athletes. And studies done in these super athletes, these professional athletes, like the guys that win the Tour de France, they have such wonderful mitochondria that they have what we call metabolic flexibility, where they can burn, you know, carbs and fat intermittently and going back and forth very freely without any problems. And one of the things they have is they have a very high antioxidant system in their mitochondria that helps protect the mitochondria from damage. I have a friend who coaches in the Tour de France, and he points out that a lot of these super athletes appear to eat sugar without a problem. Now, my belief is that if they pounded themselves with sugar and fructose, that they would get into trouble over time. But it is interesting. And there's this naked mole rat. And this is a little guy who burrows into the sand in South Africa. And they live in these burrows where there's almost no oxygen, right? Even though they have a very low oxygen system. I mean, there's low oxygen there and it would normally kill most animals. They've developed a system where they can survive in that low oxygen state. And one way they do that is they produce huge amounts of antioxidants in their mitochondria that protect them from the effects of hypoxia. And it's interesting, there's a fructose story there too, but I should probably bring that up later. But basically, if you can have super mitochondria, you can survive under a lot of stress and you can survive in the presence of sugar. I should say that these little naked mole rats make fructose to survive. But they don't suffer the consequences of the fructose because of this high-powered antioxidant system they develop.
To clarify for listeners, because I think a lot of people hear antioxidants and they think exogenous antioxidants. So they think, you know, antioxidants from fruits and vegetables and things like that. But these are antioxidants that our bodies are creating endogenously, right?
That's right. They're making it themselves. There's one called NRF2. And this antioxidant is strongly associated with living longer. So I have a friend at the Karolinska who studies this antioxidant, and he can show that in many, many species, that if you can maintain a high NRF2, you can live longer. And it's actually linked with sugar, because if you eat sugar, you induce oxidative stress to the mitochondria. You know, you can accelerate aging in animals by giving them fructose. And so fructose does this by making the mitochondria put them under stress. So that hummingbird is creating oxidative stress in his mitochondria. And that would normally be associated with developing obesity and all these complications that would persist, right? But by keeping the antioxidant system high, which the hummingbird has genetically, by having that very high antioxidant system, he can protect his mitochondria. And the super athlete has this incredible antioxidant system. And the naked mole rat, which lives 30 times longer than a normal rat. And so it lives like 30 years, whereas a normal rat lives 2 years. It's thought to be because of this NRF2, this antioxidant system. But, you know, it's interestingly, you know, this NRF2 system can be knocked down. And one way it can be knocked down is with fructose. And so, you know, I keep thinking, well, you know, the hummingbird is eating all the sugar. He's got this high NRF2. Can over time this be weathered down and knocked down? And that's why I'd like to see more studies done in the hummingbird and in, you know, the naked mole rat where they have this NRF2, because, you know, we know that if you take human cells and you treat them with fructose, the NRF2 is knocked down and you get this oxidative stress and you can accelerate aging. And so it's a really interesting thing, you know. So the antioxidants in the mitochondria are really important at protecting the mitochondria from the complications of obesity, diabetes, and aging. And fructose, you know, is usually something that makes things worse, and things like these antioxidants can protect against fructose. And so some animals that are eating a lot of fructose or making a lot of fructose seem to do well because they have high levels of this antioxidants. But like us, we normally don't. But if you're superhuman, you know.
Jealous.
Yeah, I'm jealous of those guys too.
So I'm so glad you're using these words, stress, and you dropped in the word metabolic flexibility, which is something that our listeners love hearing about and we talk about a lot in this show. So I think a foundational question here, because you're talking about activating the stressed out state and how that's a problem. What is that survival switch and how is it different from being in the survival state of fasting, which has a lot of benefits to it?
So let's go, you know, so the very first major discovery we had was that there seemed to be this substance in our blood called uric acid. And this uric acid, you know, is generated from foods we eat, but we also can make it. And this uric acid, when it gets high, it can be associated with a disease called gout. And so you can get these, like, uric acid can crystallize in high concentration. And these crystals end up in the joints, particularly the big toe, and you get gout. Now, it was noted a long time ago that gout is associated with being overweight or obese. And it's also associated with being diabetic, and it's associated with all kinds of conditions that aren't, you know, particularly what we would like to be. So for a long time, it was thought that, oh, you know, people who are overweight or obese are at an increased risk for getting gout, and it's really the obesity that's leading to the gout. But in fact, our work started to suggest that uric acid might actually have a role in driving obesity. And we found evidence that people with high uric acids were at risk of developing obesity and of developing diabetes. And so that led us to try to understand what could raise the uric acid, and it took us to fructose. And fructose, when you give fructose to an animal, normally animals regulate their weight just beautifully. So during the, you know, they, if you overfeed it, or it will gain weight, but then you stop overfeeding it, it will come back to normal weight. If you, you know, fast it, it will lose weight because you're taking away its calories, but then as soon as you let it eat again, it will go right back to the weight it wants to be. And most animals want to carry a little bit of fat, but not a lot of fat.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
Doesn't it go back to the weight that correlates to the season?
Yes. Yes, it does. So usually in the spring, animals and the summer, animals will really regulate their weight well. But as winter comes and, you know, and food becomes less available, animals will start to increase their weight. in the fall in preparation for winter. And the biggest case, of course, are animals that hibernate. You know, like there's some animals that they can't find enough food during the winter that they will actually hibernate and they will drop their metabolism. They'll go into a burrow or something and they'll just basically go to sleep and drop their heart rate and drop their temperatures. And they won't eat, they won't drink, they won't pee, anything like that for maybe 3 to 6 months. The bear can hibernate for 4 to 6 months. And during that time, it's not eating or peeing or anything. It lives off its fat during that time. And the fat doesn't just provide energy, but when the fat's broken down, it produces water. So there's this really interesting thing. We don't think of fat as a source of water normally. Most of us don't. But fat is a source of calories, and it's a source of water. And, you know, when you eat food, you're making calories you eat are turned into energy. And most of the time, we think of energy as this thing, ATP is what we call it in science. And it's basically a chemical that, you know, activates processes and generates energy. And so this ATP is what we usually call our immediate energy. But there's also a stored energy, and that's fat. So when you're eating calories, they usually are either burned as active calories like ATP, or they're stored as fat. And then the fat is later burned to generate energy when you're not eating any food. So the fat becomes that source of energy when there's no food around. So these animals, all animals like to have a little fat, because they want, you know, in case something happens and they don't get any food for a while, they can basically generate the energy they need from their fat, but they also generate water from their fat. So fat becomes a survival tool for animals in the wild. And it kind of led to my, you know, nature wants us to be fat, because these animals would, like, for example, if they're going to, If you're a bird and you're going to migrate 10,000 kilometers, you want to have enough fat so that you can burn it and get the water and energy you need, so you don't have to try to find food when you're halfway over the ocean, you know? Because if you're a land bird, that's not a good thing to be, you know? So anyway, so what happens is these animals will gain weight dramatically in preparation. This is the cool. They do it in preparation before they know there's no food around. So beginning in the fall, for example, the bear will start gaining 8 to 10 pounds a day. And it does that by eating huge amounts of food. So normally I told you, you know, animals regulate their weight. So they have a sensation of when they're full, and so they won't keep eating, but they lose that sensation of fullness in the fall. And suddenly they will keep eating, and they will eat huge amounts of food, and they'll get fat, and then they'll survive with that fat when they hibernate. So there's a little bit of evidence that people also tend to gain weight during the winter months, as you probably have read.
Hi friends, I'm about to tell you how to get an exclusive discount on one of my favorite products for truly upgrading your health on a cellular level. So the new year is upon us, and it's often a time where people are really trying to instill new habits and really upgrade their health. There's something I have been using for years, not just at the new year. Literally every single day of my life, I am not making that up. Even when I travel, I have a way to address it then, which I will tell you about. And it's something that is so easy and feels amazing. That is red light and near infrared therapy. Okay, so friends, you could go somewhere and pay a lot of money to do red light, near infrared therapy sessions, or you could just bring it to your home and use it every single day. That's what I do. I've been using Juve red and near infrared light therapy devices for so long. There are so many clinically proven benefits of red light therapy. That includes improving your skin. Yes, you really will notice it. Faster muscle recovery, reduced pain and inflammation, enhance sleep, and so much more. I use it in the morning and evening as ambient light because it actually mimics the setting and rising sun, and then I sort of run it throughout the day as well to help combat all of the blue light that we're exposed to, which can have a negative effect on our health. Whenever I have muscle pain, I shine Juve on the muscle. For me, it has made the pain go away instantly, and then for chronic pain, when I do continued sessions, it's made it dissipate. One of my good friends, who is a doctor, uses these devices on his, shall we say, manhood for benefits there. Yes, it can help in that department as well. I honestly could not imagine my life without Juve. You will just feel so good using these devices. People also post all the time in our Facebook group of their pets gravitating towards the Juve because intuitively they just know that it's good for them. The reason Juve can address so many things related to health is because it actually affects our cells on the mitochondrial level. Basically, it makes those cells perform better. And when those cells are performing better, everything just works better. That's why, yes, Juve can help with your energy as well. I've been recommending Juve specifically for years because the quality of their devices are the best. Their modular design allows for a variety of setup options to give you flexibility. The treatments are so easy. You can do them in as little as 10 minutes, or you can be using it all throughout the day like I do. All you have to do is relax and let your body take in the light. They also have their Juve Go, which you can travel with. Yes, that is how I really do use this every single day. That Go is also great for targeting specific areas of your body, like hurting joints or sore muscles. Honestly, friends, health doesn't have to be hard. It doesn't have to be complicated. If you're looking to enhance your health and wellness this new year, start with what matters, which is your cells. And Juve has an amazing offer just for our audience. You can go to juve.com/ifpodcast and use the coupon code ifpodcast to get a discount on your qualifying order. Again, that's joovv.com/ifpodcast to get an exclusive discount on your order. Pick up Juve today. Some exclusions apply. I really hope you guys can experience Juve. It really is one of my favorite things. And we'll put all this information in the show notes. All right, now back to the show. So do we gain during the winter? Or do we gain leading up to the winter?
Well, that's a good question. For the, you know, for the animals that hibernate, they will keep gaining until they actually hibernate. And then when they're hibernating, they're obviously not eating at all. We tend to keep eating into the winter as well as during the, actually we're pretty much eating too much all the time if you look. And so the problem is we've, you know, it's as if we have activated this switch to gain weight in kind of a 24/7 pattern. So, you know, and so, but this was one of the questions that I, you know, we had. So what happened is we realized that these animals were gaining weight in the fall, and they weren't just gaining weight. They were eating more. They were hungry. They were thirsty, and they also became insulin resistant. And they, you know, I mean, they developed these features we call the metabolic syndrome. So they're like foraging for food, and they're eating too much, and they're getting fatty liver. And the fats are going up in their blood as well as in their adipose tissue, and they're getting insulin resistant. And we go, oh my God, this is what we call abnormal. This is what we call metabolic syndrome. You know, we consider this almost a disease among people, right? But if you're a bear, this is like normal. This is what you want. It's like a survival pathway, because if they didn't do this, they might get into trouble when there's no food around. It's kind of late then to store fat. So we realized that this whole process was really a survival switch, and that it was turned on, and it was something that animals do to help them survive. And this was the first big discovery that, you know, really in our group, was that there was this survival switch and the metabolic syndrome. What we call, you know, when people come in and they go, yeah, my hemoglobin A1C is high, my blood sugar is a little high, I've got high triglycerides in my blood. This is like part of a syndrome. You have activated a switch. That's what's going on. And so this was the first big thing. And then the question was, you know, why would insulin resistance be a survival switch? You know, why would that be part of a survival switch? It causes diabetes. Diabetes, you know, is associated with increased risk for death. Why would an animal want to be pre-diabetic? And the interesting part is that the brain you know, loves glucose. It's its favorite fuel. Okay. Glucose is its favorite fuel. It will use ketones as well, but it loves glucose as its ideal fuel. Glucose is regulated by insulin, and insulin is the hormone that goes up in our blood, drives glucose into tissues. But it only there's certain tissues that are particularly insulin responsive, and the big one is muscle. So when you become insulin resistant, there's less glucose going into the muscle. So the glucose begins to collect in the blood, and the brain doesn't really require insulin, at least for much of the brain. And so it's a way of shunting the glucose from the muscle to the brain. So the animals, if the animal could think about survival, if it really could do that, it would want to have the glucose that it has be preferentially used for its thinking rather than for its muscle. Because if you can't think, you're not going to do well out in the wild. So insulin resistance is really a way to help an animal when it does not have enough food around to help preserve the glucose, mainly for brain function. And there's a, you know, scientist that I've worked with who've studied starvation and things like that. And when you starve, not only does your insulin levels go down, but you become relatively insulin resistant as well. So it's all meant to kind of help, you know, when there's no food around, you want that glucose primarily to go to the brain.
So the big paradigm shift here, or also a debate and a chicken and egg question, is it sounds like some people will say you become overweight or obese and that causes metabolic syndrome. But this sounds more like metabolic syndrome has a purpose to make us overweight and obese.
Yeah, metabolic syndrome is really another name for a collection of signs and symptoms to help you survive a period of time when there's no food. So if you want to maximize, you know, how to help yourself during a time when there's no food, you want to have the metabolic syndrome because you want to be insulin resistant. You want to have high fats in your blood and your liver and everywhere so that you have enough fuel to survive when there's no food around.
So what's happening when we practice intermittent fasting? Is that stimulating all of this because we're in a quote, a starvation state during the fast?
Okay. So when you quit eating, you're actually not necessarily activating the switch right away, right? And because you have fat already, everybody has some fat. When you fast, you begin by burning the glycogen and fat that you have. And so a normal animal, if it starts fasting, will not activate the switch. And when the animal that gets really fat, like the bear, and he gets really fat, and then there's winter comes and there's no food around, and that's usually the time when they can't find any more food, they'll hibernate and they switch into a burning phase. So first they burn the glycogen, which is the carb stores, and they disappear within a day or two, and then they will burn the fat, and it's a very healthy thing. They're not foraging, they're not hungry, they're sleeping, and they're just burning the fat, and they get rid of the fat. And then in the spring, you know, they may have just a tiny bit of fat left, and many times they won't have any fat left, and that may actually help stimulate them to wake up, actually. And so then they wake up and they're back to normal, okay? So when you're intermittent fasting, you know, most people who are intermittent fasting have some fat stores, and they have, I mean, everybody has some fat stores and some glycogen, right? So if you intermittent fast, you are burning the glycogen and you're burning the fat. And when you're burning the glycogen and fat, everything is fine. You're not in trouble. You're not in trouble. But as soon as the fat burns away, then you know what they have to burn? The protein. That's the only thing, yeah, the muscle. And one of the first things that's released is uric acid. And that is like an alarm signal, and it turns on the switch, and they start foraging. They're looking for food, and they're desperate. But now they've turned on the switch in a situation where they really are starving. Okay? So like they've done studies with penguins, and the emperor penguin is this magnificent bird. I mean, it is the most, I want to go to Antarctica and see one of these guys. I mean, it's just the most, and apparently there was a penguin that was like 6 feet tall once.
I was going to say, how tall are they? Yeah, they're tall.
These are like 4 feet, I think three to four feet or so, three feet maybe. But there was a penguin that was 6 feet. That's the penguin but it's extinct now, unfortunately, the Colossus penguin. But anyway, the emperor penguin is this huge penguin, and it will get fat in the Antarctic before it nests. And the emperor is one of the few birds that nests during the winter. So it's nesting during the winter in the Antarctic, okay? And it has to store, so it does the same thing. It gets hugely fat. I mean, hugely fat. It almost doubles its weight. Its liver gets really fat. Birds particularly get fatty liver. And then it waddles in inland. And then the male actually does the nesting because the male is a bigger bird, so it can carry more fat. And so it can survive longer than the female in the winter. And so when it's nesting, the male will sit on the egg because, you know, it knows that it may not, you know, that winter's a long time down there and that it can take a while. I mean, it wants to have enough fat. And so the male has more fat so it can last longer. But sometimes the male doesn't have enough fat. And if it runs out of its fat, while it's burning the fat, it completely feels good. It just sits there. It's not in distress. Same thing's true with people who are fasting. If you're just burning the carbs and the fat, it's generally not a stressful situation, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, survival. But once the muscle starts breaking down, the penguin will desert. It will leave the egg. And it will try desperately to get back to the coast to get some food. And it will start making sounds, calling sounds, and foraging. And, you know, it's like a stressful period. And if it doesn't get food, it will die. And so that what's interesting is that what heralds that shift is a rise in uric acid. Because uric acid is released and it is generated when muscle is breaking down. So that was actually a clue to us that uric acid might be a survival factor. And so it was interesting that fructose raised uric acid. And then we started studying, you know, well, why does fructose raise the uric acid and what's the uric acid doing? And what we found is that when you give fructose to an animal, it creates a pseudo-starvation state. So what happens is when you eat fructose, inside the cell, the fructose causes this drop in phosphate. And phosphate's like critical for energy production. Phosphate's part of ATP. So ATP, the P part is a phosphate. And the way the ATP works is it donates a phosphate to generate and drive chemical reactions. And that's how energy is activated, really. And so what happens is when you eat fructose, there's this acute fall in phosphate inside the cell. And when that happens, the ATP levels fall. The breakdown of ATP gets turned into uric acid. And then the uric acid keeps the energy levels in the cell low for a prolonged period of time. And it does so by causing oxidative stress to those energy factories that are making ATP. So it causes oxidative stress to these mitochondria, and that kind of suppresses the mitochondrial function. Now, again, if you're a super athlete, that's not going to happen. Your mitochondria are strong enough to weather it. If you're a hummingbird, it's not going to happen. You know, because at least acutely, you know, you can weather that storm. But for most of us, when that mitochondrial stress occurs, it suppresses the mitochondria, keeps the ATP levels low, and that activates an alarm system. Basically, the animal thinks to itself, you know what? My energy levels are low. I'm in trouble. And, you know, normally, if my energy levels are low, my fat's going to kick in and start being broken down to provide that missing energy. But what fructose does is it blocks the burning of the fat at the same time. So it's suppressing the ability to break down the fat. And so when the ATP levels fall, the only way to replenish it is to eat more. You can't use that fat because it's been, the fructose is blocking your ability to burn the fat. And so what happens is you become hungry and you start eating more. And then the more food comes in. And again, you've got this shunt going on. So more of the calories are going to stored fat rather than to ATP. And so the ATP levels will continue to stay low for a while. And then eventually you'll correct it, but at the expense of eating a lot more food. So it's like this brilliant system. Basically, when you eat fructose, it makes your body thinks it's starving. And so it will continue to stimulate processes to store fat, to become insulin resistant. But you're actually not starving. It's pseudo-starvation because you have fat on board, you know, and it's only getting bigger. So more went from this. So it's a way to get the animal, instead of regulating its weight so perfectly, you know, I'm going to stay skinny. Now suddenly you're gaining weight. And you know, when people are young, when you're 20 years old and you're out running on the beach and you have all the energy in the world, you can drink that soft drink and it's not going to really have a big effect. You're not going to see sudden weight change or anything like that because your mitochondria are pretty healthy and it takes, you know, repeated insults, repeated times. But in this world where 70% of processed food has sugar in it, where soft drinks are everywhere, where, you know, where they're putting, you know, all this kind of foods around and this high fructose corn syrups being added to everything, you know, we're being, you know, hit hard. 15-20% of our diet is from these added sugars. And so we're chronically activating this switch. And some of us do it better than others or worse, depending on how you look at it. And so some people gain weight a little bit easier than others. Some are still doing pretty well. And you can battle it by exercise and you can battle it by willpower, but you know, this is a biologic process. So it's hard to have the willpower chronically when there's a biologic process saying that you're hungry, this looks good. So this is sort of what's going on.
So basically, when we're eating, you know, sugar and high fructose corn syrup and things like that, it's really ironic because we're taking in calories, we're taking in energy, but it's stopping our body from actually burning energy. So our body needs to eat more, which is ironic.
That's exactly how it works. It's like tricking the system, but it's, you know, and so it turns out when we started studying this, we realized that glucose is actually really there as an immediate fuel. It's really meant to make ATP. It's not meant to really be a storage mechanism. It isn't. Fructose, though, is the carb that's really trying to aim at storing energy as opposed to immediately using energy. Now, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say, well, but I know that eating bread and rice and potatoes and French fries, and they don't have fructose in them, but they're fatty. I mean, we know that from low-carb diets, how powerful bad carbs can be. And so, you know, this was a challenge. This was a challenge to me because, you know, when I was originally doing this work and we were giving fructose to animals and they developed metabolic syndrome, and then we could see that, you know, a lot of animals were eating fructose to create metabolic syndrome as a survival mechanism. I mean, it seemed like the answer was going to be easy. We just had to avoid foods with fructose. And I even wrote a book, you know, the Sugar Fix. It was back in 2008. It was one of the first books to, you know, to say, you know, the problem is fructose. It's not anything else. And I had a lot of people write me, email me, tell me, oh my God, when I quit eating sugar, I lost 25 pounds. I feel great. Thank you so much. Or, you know, and of course you can't completely stop eating sugar. And I don't recommend that either. But, you know, if it's a birthday or something, you know, I'll eat sugar. But anyway, the idea was to really limit sugar. And then I had these people contacting me and saying, you know, I'm sure sugar is important, but I have to cut out all carbs. I really have to cut out starch, and especially high glycemic carbs, carbs that release glucose into the blood, like potatoes, and rice, and cereal, and chips. And I sort of knew that they were right, because I knew that when I ate bread, it seemed like, you know, it seemed like I would gain weight. And you know, there's not a lot of sugar in bread. There's a little. So then I said, okay, well, I'll buy bread that doesn't have much sugar at all. And I found that I still, you know, there was something about bread and me that was making me gain weight. And then we started, you know, trying to figure it out. And then we had this really major insight. It was not our discovery. People had already discovered that the body can make fructose. There's only one way. You can only make fructose from glucose. There's a specific enzyme. And normally that enzyme is pretty quiet. When we're born, we do not really have that enzyme anywhere except in certain regions of our kidney. But otherwise, it's really not around. And we call it the polyol pathway. But it was known, gosh, it was known when I was in medical school, that in diabetes, the body can make fructose and that this polyol pathway is turned on. So it was known that once you become diabetic, you can make fructose even if you're not eating it. And there were studies showing that particularly when diabetes was out of control, that you could have high fructose levels in your blood and your urine. And we've confirmed that since. And then the question was, well, how does it work? And it turns out that the enzyme that makes fructose gets turned on when you're starving, kind of makes sense. It gets turned on when you're dehydrated. That makes sense because fructose will make fat. Fat can be a source of water. And it can be turned on when glucose levels in the blood are high, like in diabetes. And that sort of made sense because in diabetes, because when the blood glucose goes up, it makes the blood concentrated. And what happens is it makes you thirsty. So it's sort of like another way to create dehydration. And so we said, aha, well, what about high glycemic carbs? So when you eat bread, the glucose gets released. We call it high glycemic carbs because certain foods, when you eat it, the glucose level will go up in the blood, you know, right after you eat it. So if let's say you have a blood sugar of 80 and you eat some bread, your blood sugar might go up to 120, you know, it may just go up that fast with just eating a slice or two of bread. And that's because when the bread is broken down, it releases glucose very rapidly. And some of that gets into the blood and it makes the blood concentration go up. So it's like a transient or temporary diabetic state. You know, you're not diabetic when you eat, you know, bread, but your glucose shoots up. And so you have transient, temporary high glucose or hyperglycemia. And that turns out to be enough to activate the switch. And what we found was that high glycemic carbs get turned into fructose in the body. And if you block that, and we did that in a big, you know, we did it in laboratory mice, but we did it beautifully and knocked it out. And when that happens, those animals are incredibly protected. They don't get fatty liver. They don't get insulin resistance. They still gain a little weight, but it's a healthy obesity. It's sort of driven by insulin. But it's not actually the mechanism that where you get fatty liver and insulin resistance is not from the effects of insulin itself. It's from the fructose. And so it turns out that high glycemic carbs are bad. They are really bad. But it isn't really just from stimulating insulin. It's because they get turned into fructose. And now there was just recently a study showing that when you eat glucose, you're making fructose in the body. So it's been shown in humans now. So I'm feeling pretty confident that this is a major mechanism. So that's why low-carb diets are so great, because you are restricting sugar, which is fructose, you know, which contains fructose. You're restricting high fructose corn syrup, But you're also restricting high glycemic carbs. So you're restricting the main way that the body can make fructose because it uses glucose. And if you restrict foods that make a lot of glucose, it's going to work. And so that was like, wow, that explains the low-carb diet.
For listeners, you will have to get Nature Wants Us to Be Fat because he goes deep into all of the technicalities of all these studies that you've conducted, and they're just really, really fascinating. And so just for listeners so they can get the full resource. So big question, fructose, we keep saying fructose, sugar, high fructose corn syrup. Does this apply to whole fruits as well?
Oh, great question. You know, so again, you know, we're studying this, right? And I'm going, oh my gosh, you know, if this is correct, then I shouldn't be eating an apple or a banana. And I love fruit, you know, and fruit's healthy. There are 200 papers out there plus that show that if you're eating natural fruits, you tend to do well. But there's an interesting thing. It was noted 20 years ago by the pediatricians that fruit juice was not the same as natural fruits. And they actually did studies and they found that if children drank fruit juice, that was associated with obesity. And the pediatric societies came out and said, hey, you've got to limit how much fruit juice you're drinking, especially if you're giving it to children, because they can get obesity from it. It can stunt growth. It can do all kinds of things, but particularly the obesity and the diabetes were strongly associated with fruit juice. So what was the difference? Well, it turns out that when you eat a natural fruit, one fruit has like, you know, 4 to 6 grams of fructose, typically. Some have a little bit more, but that's much less than drinking a soft drink that has 30 grams of fructose. So we're talking a big difference in the amount. Okay, so that's one. The second thing is when you eat a natural fruit, there's fiber in it, and fiber slows the absorption of the fructose. And that's important because the way the fructose drops the energy in the cell is like a chemical reaction. It's not based on just the amount. It's based on the concentration. So if the fructose hits there and it's at a high concentration, the energy falls a lot and the switch is turned on a lot. But if the energy just falls, if you get only a little bit of fructose there, the energy just falls a little bit and it's not going to create the same thing. It's going to be a much milder activation of the switch. So the switch is really like a dimmer. It's not like on and off. Okay. So when you drink a soft drink, you're drinking a ton of fructose, 30 grams, and you're drinking it in about 5 minutes or less. Some people just guzzle it. So you get this big wave of fructose that hits the liver and big activation of the switch. But when you eat a fruit, and especially like you're eating it with a meal and there's all this fiber and everything slows the absorption, you're only eating a small amount, you don't get the same dose, okay? You don't get the same concentration. And there's another thing, the intestinal lining can inactivate about 4 or 5 grams of fructose. So it turns out that the fructose in vegetables gets inactivated. So you can eat vegetables, eat like sweet potatoes can have a little bit of fructose in it, but it's not going to make you fat because your intestine's going to inactivate it. Now, if you coat it with brown sugar, and, you know, there's a way to beat everything. So you can make it worse, but you know, and so just keep in mind, it's like the dose, and the dose is what happens in the wild. The bear doesn't eat, you know, 10 berries and then a nut, you know, it's eating thousands of berries and grapes at a time. And I mean it. There's some studies that show that they can eat like 10,000 berries in 24 hours. So, but anyway, so fruit. So we decided to do a study in people. You know, it's good enough to talk about this, but you know, let's do it. So we gave overweight ladies a low fructose diet, and that included low fruit, low everything, man. Anything that had fructose in it. It was limited. And one group got that, but one group got the low fructose diet, but we added back natural fruits. So they really wasn't a low fructose diet. It was really a low added sugar diet, but they couldn't drink fruit juice and stuff like that. And it turned out that even though the people got natural fruits, they still improved their metabolic syndrome. They actually, and they tolerated it better. They felt better on the diet. So, I think that natural fruits are good. I think it's possible to overdo it. If you're eating like a huge amount of fruit, you know, in front of the TV, you know, you're probably going to activate the switch.
Would a fourth factor in the fruit be how you talk about how we lost our ability to synthesize vitamin C actually as a mechanism to encourage weight gain? So would the vitamin C and the fruit also help mitigate the effects?
Yeah, so there's this really interesting thing, you know, we have to take vitamins, you know, when we take a vitamin, it's because we used to make that stuff, but we don't make it anymore. So vitamin C, you know, humans, our ancestors could make vitamin C, but we lost the ability to make that vitamin C. And so we have to get vitamin C, or we can get a disease called scurvy. And, you know, one of the great discoveries was James Lind, a surgeon who was on a ship, and all these guys were getting this terrible aching joints and bleeding joints and bleeding gums. And they had scurvy, and he gave them some lemons and oranges, and he could cure it. And it was later figured out it was the vitamin C. So, you know, people go, why would we have lost vitamins, the ability to make vitamin C? There's no advantage to being vitamin C deficient. You know, in fact, you're going to get scurvy. So why would that happen? And so it's been a mystery why we would lose vitamin C. And one of the things about vitamin C is it's an antioxidant. And antioxidants are supposed to be good. So why would you lose an antioxidant? That would make you live, you would think you might live shorter if you didn't have that, or a shorter time. So it's been kind of a mystery. But when we were studying this, we realized that vitamin C, it turns out to be an antioxidant, and it's involved in the survival switch. Remember how I told you how mitochondria that are really healthy have a lot of antioxidant activity, and they can block the oxidative stress induced by fructose. So when you give fructose to an animal, you create this oxidative stress to the mitochondria, and it's driven by the uric acid. But the oxidative stress suppresses the mitochondria and reduces the amount of ATP produced so that the energy that comes in gets converted to fat. So what happens is the oxidative stress suppresses the ATP production so that the calories are converted to stored energy instead of to instant energy. So oxidative stress is actually a survival tool to prepare you for winter. So it's actually to help you store fat. So it turns out that the mutation for vitamin C occurred at the time of the dinosaur extinction. And this huge asteroid, Chicxulub, it was called, came sailing in from, you know, the heavens and smashed the earth and caused a major extinction. And all the dinosaurs basically died except for the birds, which were sort of a dinosaur-like thing. And it creamed the animals, and the primates got creamed. There were a lot of primates. There were some primates, we think, genetically. But for some reason, some of those primates survived. And it turns out it was that most of those primates, the lemurs also survived, and they did not get this mutation. But all the other primates, there was a common ancestor. And they somehow, this one guy lost his vitamin C through a mutation, and it provided a survival advantage. And the survival advantage was that it led to a greater oxidative stress to those mitochondria from just even a small amount of fructose. And so it allowed you to store fat more easily. The way we proved that was we took mice and we worked with them and genetically got genetically altered mice that were vitamin C deficient, just like we are. And you have to keep them on a low dose of vitamin C or they will get scurvy. Okay. So now we had them on a low dose of vitamin C just to keep them from getting scurvy. But now we give one group a high dose of vitamin C and the other group we give a low dose. And so we have two groups of mice. We have a mouse group that has a high vitamin C and we have a group that has a low vitamin C. And then we gave them sugar. Actually, we gave them high fructose corn syrup. And both groups love, you know, all animals love high fructose corn syrup. And we put it in their drinking water. They were happy. And they activated their switch and they started eating more. So they don't just get the calories from the sugar water. They become hungry and they eat more chow. And they eat more. They got fatty liver. They became pre-diabetic. The whole bit. But the group that had the low amount of vitamin C got a lot more fatter. They got almost, 40% more fat. And so we could show that the vitamin C mutation could help these animals survive when there wasn't much fruit, so that when it would help them survive if there wasn't much fructose around. But if we give them more fructose, then they actually become fatter than their controls because they're getting more damage to their mitochondria. So they can survive. So it turns out that when fruit is first immature, the seeds are immature, right? So that if the fruit falls, there's going to be no germination. The seeds aren't going to be able to make a new fruit tree. And it's high in vitamin C at that time. And so animals won't gain much fat by eating it. So they tend not to go after immature fruit. But as the fruit ripens, the sugar content goes up and the vitamin C content goes down. And so it's almost like the plant knows that the plant wants the fruit to be eaten when the seeds are mature so that it can promote a new tree. And by making the fruit ripe with low vitamin C, the fruit, the animals know that they're going to get more fat from eating it. So they learned this evolutionarily. It isn't like they know this, but this kind of gets trapped, brought into the evolution of how these animals work. So what's happened is vitamin C, when the fruit that we tend to like a fruit that's less mature. We like the tart fruits. We like the fruits that don't have as much sugar. We don't like the ripe mushy fruits that a lot of animals will go after. We want it when it's tart and high in vitamin C. So when we're eating natural fruits, we're eating the fruit has fiber and potassium and vitamin C and all these things help counter it. So that is why natural fruits are good, even though they contain fructose. But things like fruit juices and sugar, why they're so effective at activating the switch.
Okay, friends. People often ask me, what is the one supplement I cannot imagine my life without? And while there are a lot of supplements out there, a lot of ones that I love, a lot of ones that I advocate, there is one supplement that inspired me to create a whole supplement line. And that's because I take it every single day, and I really can't imagine my life without it. That would be Serrapeptase. And I'm about to tell you how to get up to 15% off on a special bottle version that we have that also saves you money. So Serrapeptase is a proteolytic enzyme created by the Japanese silkworm. Now we make it in a lab, so it is vegan. When you take this enzyme in the fasted state, it actually goes into your bloodstream and it breaks down problematic proteins in your body. These are things that your immune system is often reacting to and that create inflammation. That's why it can do incredible, amazing things like clear your sinuses. That's why I first started taking it. You can completely say goodbye to allergy meds with Serrapeptase. It reduces inflammation and pain. My friend just started taking it for her back pain and told me she was shocked at how effective it was, more so than the pain pills she normally was taking. It can help reduce cholesterol. It's even been shown in clinical studies to break down amyloid plaque in vitro and in vivo. Basically, it is a wonder supplement. And what's super cool about it is that it specifically breaks down those problematic non-living proteins. It doesn't harm form healthy tissue, it actually helps protect that. That's because the function of the original enzyme in the silkworm is to break down the cocoon of the silkworm without actually harming the silkworm itself. And there aren't studies on this, but I really believe it can help catalyze your fast by enhancing the natural process of autophagy. Again, not studies on that, but from a mechanistic standpoint, it totally makes sense. Here's the thing. I was taking so many different brands of serapeptase, and they always seemed a little hard on my stomach and have problematic ingredients in them, especially special enteric coatings where they wouldn't disclose what that was made of, which meant it probably contained problematic plastics. I knew I needed to make a change. That's why I created my Avalon X serapeptase. It's what launched my Avalon X line. I will never stop taking it. It's one of my favorite things in my life, and the effects I experience are profound, and I hear that from all of you guys as well. We test it multiple times for purity and potency. It's free of all problematic fillers and common allergens. It comes in a glass bottle to help prevent leaching of plastics into ourselves and the environment. And we even use the minimum amount of stickiness in the label on the bottle to help reduce problematic compounds. So if you want to tackle your inflammation, clear your brain fog, oh, it's amazing for brain fog, stop your allergies, attack amyloid plaque, reduce pain, so many things, you need serapeptase. And you can get 10% off with the coupon code Melanie Avalon. But here's another thing. We actually have a special large bottle. It's the only supplement that we have right now in a large bottle. It's the 180 version, and it saves you money. If serapeptase is a part of your daily life, like it is mine, you definitely want our large bottle size, 180 capsules. It's the best way to save. And again, you can save even more with my Melanie Avalon 10% discount, or you can get 15% off that as well if you get a subscription, which, by the way, with a subscription, you could pause or cancel anytime after your first order. So it kind of makes sense to do a subscription because you save even more. If you want a supplement that you can actually feel the difference, I promise you, serapeptase is the way to go. And then you might end up like me and want to give it as gifts to everybody because it's that incredible and can address so many issues. You can get this at avalonx.us. That's AVALONX.US. Again, there is the 90 capsule size and the 180 capsule size. You save more with the 180. Use the coupon code Melanie Avalon for 10% off or get a subscription for 15% off. And we'll put all this information in the show notes. Well, again, listeners, if you get Nature Wants Us to Be Fat, it has an entire outline of a diet to follow. And because I bet listeners are probably thinking, oh no, what do I eat now? So it's a really, really helpful resource. I want to be really respectful of your time. Can I ask you one last super granular question that I apologize in advance to listeners because it's going to be so granular? It's based off of what we were talking about recently with some email exchanges.
Yes, please go ahead.
I had asked Rick about fructose's effect on AMPK in the cells. And listeners might actually be familiar with AMPK because we do talk about it a lot on this show as a pathway that's activated from fasting and how it, you know, creates a lot of benefits in the fasted state by signaling the need for energy and a lot of benefits from that. Okay, so here's my question. So in one of the studies that I was reading, and I sent you the quote from it last night, but it was saying that fructose actually activates both AMPK in the cell and AMPD2 specifically, which is like counteracts AMPK and has the opposite effect of AMPK. And I'm probably completely bastardizing this, but in layman's terms, that was my takeaway, is that it actually stops fat burning and counteracts the beneficial effects of AMPK. Okay, here's my question. So one of the other studies you had sent me was It was talking about metformin and how metformin can actually block AMPD2. So if you were to, and this is hypothetical, and I don't even know if this practically could happen, but if you took in fructose and then you took in a compound like metformin, and if you could block AMPD2, would that actually be all beneficial then? Because then you'd be stimulating AMPK from the fructose, but you wouldn't be getting the AMPD2. So you'd be just getting the benefits.
Well, that's a pretty heavy question, but let me just kind of just say a few things and I'll try to get to that answer. And I think you're onto something, but let me just begin by saying, you know, that AMPK is, you know, is this wonderful pathway that when you activate it, it burns fat and it keeps glucose levels down. And it gets inhibited in diabetes. And it's inhibited, and our group showed that it's inhibited by AMPD. and by uric acid. And AMPD is the enzyme that makes uric acid in the fructose pathway. So it turns out that fructose activates AMPD, and AMPD makes uric acid, and they counter the effects of AMPK. Okay, so there's this kind of yin-yang where AMPK is considered the good guy, and AMPD is what dries fat. And so, you know, we actually would love to make an AMPD inhibitor, and metformin is a weak one. So metformin stimulates AMPK, and it weakly inhibits AMPD. And this is probably one reason why metformin has been found to be so beneficial. But if it could really knock down AMPD, it would be like a big time. It could be a huge winner. When we knock down AMPD, we can even cure genetically induced obesity. I mean, it's just amazing. We can block addiction for sugar. And, you know, it's just a very powerful pathway.
In theory, there could be a drug that could do that. If that happened and then you took in fructose, would you get benefits then because you stimulate AMPK? Still?
You probably would. You would. Because one thing that can stimulate AMPK is a drop in energy in the cell. So fructose drops the energy in the cell, but then the AMPD pathway and the uric acid generated inhibits the AMPK. So there's a, when you give fructose, you can show that AMPK goes up to some extent. It's actually induced, but then it's inhibited by the uric acid and the AMPD. So the net effect is that the AMPK is kept low. Now, in a true starvation state, the AMPK can override the AMPD. So if you're in a true starvation state where there's no fat around and things like that, you can really, you know, you are very minimal. AMPK will be activated. But anyway, you're right. These two players, AMPD and AMPK, the balance of that is so important in intermittent fasting and low-carb diets, in anything. AMPK should be viewed as pretty much a good guy, and AMPD is its evil counterpart, unless you're preparing for starvation. Then you want that AMPD, man.
Well, thank you for entertaining that. I was reading all the studies and I was like, I have to ask, and apologies to listeners for the random rabbit hole. Well, this has been so amazing. We only barely touched on just like a tiny bit of everything that's in your book. So listeners, go get Nature Wants Us to Be Fat. It's amazing. You will learn so many things. And Rick, I can't thank you enough for your work. I'm so excited to see what the future holds with all of your studies. And are you writing another book right now?
I'm thinking of writing another book. I haven't started yet, but I'm very interested in writing a book about discovery processes, just because I've been involved in quite a few. And, you know, kind of like what's the art of discovery, because it's sort of interesting how there's different approaches to discovering things.
Does it often start with asking why, like you were saying in the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, well, one thing that's for sure involved with almost every discovery process is just, you've got to be passionate and curious. And, you know, for sure, those two are characteristics that are constantly seen. But there's a lot of, you know, serendipity and all kinds of things that are involved. And there's certain tricks that I think can help people that I might be able to write about, that not necessarily that I've done, but that other people that I've seen others do too, you know, because I've been doing research just, you know, since the mid 80s. And so I've been around some wonderful people. I've seen, you know, Nobel laureates, I've talked to them, and I've over the years, I've just been very curious, you know, what is it? Why did that guy discover that? I'm sort of kind of interested in, you know, what was the thinking that led to that? Not so much what the science of the discovery is, but kind of like, you know, how did he figure that out? And what was the technique? And so I'm interested in that part.
I love that. I really hope you write that, because that I would just eat that up. I would love to bring you on in the future if you do and talk all about that. Well, thank you so much. This has been absolutely wonderful. Again, listeners, there will be a full transcript in the show notes, because I know we went deep into everything, but this has been so amazing, and hopefully we can talk again in the future.
Thank you, Melanie. That was just a wonderful, your knowledge is so strong. It's just really wonderful talking to you.
Oh, thank you. You're amazing. And I will talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to the Intermittent Fasting Podcast. Please remember, everything we discussed on this show does not constitute medical advice, and no patient-doctor relationship is formed. If you enjoyed the show, please consider writing a review on iTunes. We couldn't do this without our amazing team. Administration by Sharon Merriman, editing by Podcast Doctors, show notes and artwork by Brianna Joyner, transcripts by Speech Docs, and original theme composed by Leland Cox and recomposed by Steve Saunders. See you next week.